If you start a hypothetical question with, would you rather have $1 million or whatever's on the other side of that or better be really good? So here's a hypothetical question I have for you. And at first glance, what's on the other side of the or in this case might not seem like it's worth it. But I challenge you to think about it deeper. Would you rather have $1 million or the mindset of a millionaire? Hey, it's Matthew, and this is the Matthew Kent Show. Hey everyone, it's Matthew, and today on the Matthew Kent Show, we're talking about money, but really we're talking about mindset, and the two of those are related by more than just alliteration. So I want to start by thinking about somebody that we all know or we all know of, and that's one of the richest men in the world, Warren Buffett, the Oracle of Omaha, the chairman and CEO of Berkshire Hathaway, one of the best investors of all time. Again, one of the richest men in the world. I think his net worth, it's somewhere in the tens of billions of dollars, 87 billion, 90 something billion, probably pushing 100 billion by now. And as far as I can tell, just poking around on the internet a little bit, he first became a millionaire at the age of 30. Very impressive. But now here's the hypothetical question that I have for you. Let's say that at the age of 30, the government went over to Warren Buffett and said, "Hey, listen, we just don't like the fact that, everybody else around you, they're stuck where they were. There's no upward mobility, and you've, multiplied your net worth like crazy and become a millionaire. We're going to take it all away. We're going to confiscate all your wealth, all your money, all your assets, everything." Where do you think Warren Buffett would be today? Do you think he'd be that homeless guy out on the street? Do you think he'd be, working a low-wage job, with a just terrible grumbling attitude, complaining about this time that he had built up $1 million, but that the government had taken it all away? Or do you think he'd be more or less where he is now? An incredibly rich, successful man with a net worth of tens of billions of dollars, who built it all back up with what he knew, with what he knows, and with his mindset for pursuing strategies that lead to the accumulation of wealth. Because here's the thing, it's I'm not one of these guys who, when it comes to, personal development, self-help, is just like, okay, it's like magic that you just believe in whatever you want and then, you get it. There's something to, positive thinking and putting your focus on certain things. But when I talk about mindset, what I'm really thinking of is the fact that your beliefs are going to determine your actions, right? And every now and then you might have the occasional weird out of left field thing that you do that conflicts with your core beliefs, but what you believe in your head and in your heart and the mindset that you have in general is going to determine your actions. And it's your actions in general that are going to determine your results, your direction, where you're going to go, what you're going to accomplish. And so it's incredibly important to get the mindset right, because whether you know it or not, you might have beliefs that you've been holding on to for years, default strategies of how to act, how to look at the world, that are hindering your ability to achieve your goals. Now, I've mentioned in other episodes, the way I view life, it's sort of this triple constraint: time, energy, and money. Like, whatever you want to do, you need time, you need energy. That's just the fact of being a human. And then part of a fact of living in the society that we live in is that the way to facilitate the transactions that you need To get what you want done is through money. Money is literally the currency with which we transact with each other. And I'm using the word literally correctly there, not, like, oh, dude, I'm literally starving to death. That's a topic for another day. But anyways, to some extent, chances are, unless your definition of the good life is that you're going to go, live in a cabin in the woods, where you acquired the materials, just completely yourself, you went in and you made them. You're going to need money to some extent. And you depending on what it is that you want out of life, you might need a lot of it. And so for everybody, it pays to develop a mindset that leads to the accumulation of wealth. And especially because, the nice thing about capitalism, I'm not going to get too much into politics and capitalism versus socialism versus communism versus whatever. But the nice thing about capitalism is that in general, it sets it up so that you get money by providing value to society. So your pursuit of wealth, unless you do it, illegally, immorally, right, through stealing, stuff like that. But in general, if you're doing it legitimately, if you're playing by the rules of the game, you're forced to act in a way that makes society a better place through your pursuit of wealth. So today I want to talk about that pursuit of wealth. I want to talk specifically about how your mindset plays a major part of that. I want to look at 17 specific areas, 17 specific mindset changes that I think you need to make to adopt a mindset that's going to lead you towards wealth and away from being broke, away from poverty, away from living hand to mouth. So we're going to talk about all of those, but before that, we're going to take another step back and keep talking for a second about the importance of mindset. So, as a general rule, I believe that it's more profitable to leverage your strengths than it is to fix your weaknesses. And especially when we're talking about your skills. If you're really, really, really great at, spreadsheets and data and, not great at communication, I don't think you should spend all your time getting better at communication. Now, I think that there are certain critical weaknesses that need to be shored up. So if your communication is so bad that it's a major problem in your life that's hard to overcome, then yeah, maybe you need to work on it, but you don't need to become the world's all-star, best communicator ever. You just need to get it good enough that you can, that it doesn't hold you back. Now, so in other words, the formula is, in general, leverage your strengths instead of fixing up your weaknesses, but be on the lookout for any major weaknesses. And to be honest, I think the best candidate for a major weakness would be a bad mindset. Again, because we have this notion that your mindset leads to your actions, and your actions are going to determine your results. So one example of an unhealthy mindset is what would be known as a scarcity mindset. So this mindset views things like wealth, success, fame, all that kind of stuff, as it's something like, there's like a the mental image would be like there's a pie out there, and you can only slice up this pie so many ways, and so we all get a slice. And so if somebody has a lot of money, they took too big of a slice. So they're inherently evil people. They're selfish, they're greedy, because there's only so much to go around, and they've taken too much. So in this worldview, Bill Gates is inherently evil, regardless of how much good he's done for society, regardless of how much he's helped others through the products that he's created, through his foundation, his charitable foundation, regardless of, his commitment to give half his wealth away during his lifetime. All that's irrelevant. All that matters is that there's a pie out there that's for all of us to share, And he took too big of a slice for himself, and he didn't leave enough for the rest of us. It's a scarcity mindset. To whatever extent you find yourself resenting rich and successful people just for being rich and successful, you have a scarcity mindset. To whatever extent you feel it, you find it difficult to be supportive of your friends, to be truly happy for their success, you have a scarcity mindset. Now, the alternative to a scarcity mindset is an abundance mindset. This mindset says that, hey, listen, we can create more value for everyone. You know, wealth isn't a zero-sum game. We, you know, there's this pie, but we can make the pie bigger. We can create win-win situations where everyone comes out better than they were before. If you have a scarcity mindset, you know, you'll find it hard to collaborate with other people because their gains are their gains and they're your losses. If you have an abundance mindset, you're going to readily collaborate with others because you recognize that it's a great way to create value. And even this phrase, create value, is kind of something that's inherent to the abundance mindset. You know, wealth, value, these sorts of things, they don't just exist. They're created. We're not limited to dividing up the pie we have. We can make the pie bigger. We can make a new pie. We can do whatever we want, right? And so if you really want to get ahead under the abundance mindset, the way to do it is not by looking out only for your own interests, but also for the interests of others. You know, thinking, how can I provide value to other people? And, you know, so this becomes ironic that the best strategy for profit, if you want to be profitable, is to be generous. Generous with your time, generous with your knowledge, generous with your skills. You know, so one of the people that I think about here, I think about Darren Rouse. You might not know who he is. He is from Australia. He's been blogging, I think, since 2002. He's the blogger behind a blog called Digital Photography School. And he also runs one called Pro Blogger, where he then teaches people how to start a blog and all that kind of stuff. And he talks about the fact that his first product was an ebook, and it was called 31 Days to Build a Better Blog. What's so interesting is that this wasn't new material. I think there's probably a little bit of new material, but he had already done a series on his blog called 31 Days to Build a Better Blog. And so he just took all 31 of those posts and, you know, he maybe slightly updated them, maybe added a few little things here and there, and, you know, had a cover and released it as like a PDF ebook that he was selling. And, you know, he was, of course, very nervous about doing this, as we all are. And of course, these kind of fears hold us back from making money. But he was very nervous and he released it. And I think he had in the back of his mind, like, why would people buy this? You know, this is just information that I'm selling, and it's information that's all available for free online. And people did buy it. And, you know, interestingly, some of his customers told him, like, hey, listen, I know that this is all available for free online, but you have, you know, created material that has benefited me so greatly that this was the first way I ever had of paying you back. So I bought the book. Now, that's so interesting to me because what that means is that Darren's generosity beforehand, just giving everything away for free, directly led to sales when it came time to monetize. You know, he gave value and he got value. He created value for others. They became better off. And then it ended up working out in his favor financially. And that wasn't the goal. He wasn't thinking, oh, if I give everything away for free, you know, people are going to pay me later. He gave everything away for free just because that was what he was doing. He was generous. And then when he was nervous about, like, is anybody going to buy this product because I already gave it all away for free, the answer counterintuitively turned out to be yes. So there's a great book that I read last year, maybe 2 years ago. It was called Secrets of the Millionaire Mind by T. Harv Eker. And so in this book, And he very closely in this book ties mindset together with your ability to make money. But he argues that people have a financial thermostat. So just like a house has a thermostat that regulates its temperature, you know, every one of us is programmed for a certain amount of wealth. And yeah, the temperature in the house can fluctuate despite the thermostat being on due to like external circumstances. Maybe you left the windows open or something. In the same way, you know, your own level of wealth can fluctuate due to external circumstances. But as long as the thermostat is set to a certain level, that's where the house's temperature will tend to go in the long run. And the same way, if you're programmed for a certain amount of wealth, that's the way you'll go in the long run. So that's why Warren Buffett, his thermostat is programmed for an extraordinarily high amount of wealth, right? The person who was broke as a joke, and, you know, won the lucky Big Mac, you know, $1 million prize, you know, Monopoly at McDonald's, whatever kind of contest, their thermostat is programmed for broke as a joke. And so they win this money, and so for a moment, due to external circumstances, they're not broke as a joke anymore. But because the thermostat doesn't change, they end up broke as a joke again. And so in his book, he has 17 specific, he calls them wealth files. And essentially, they're mindset shifts that you need to adopt in order to be rich, successful, make a lot of money. Now, huge disclaimer I'm putting down here. Right, we're going to go through all 17 of these. So the 17 points we're about to go through come from his book. The commentary is mine, but we're going to have a huge disclaimer, which is that this is for the purposes of personal development. So these statements are going to come in the form of pithy little sayings: rich people do this, poor people do this. This is not my grand economic treatise on the nature of riches versus poverty. This is not a denial of, you know, structural aspects to poverty. This is not a societal solution for eradicating poverty. This is for the purposes of personal development. I'm talking to you, and I'm saying if you have this mindset and not this mindset, it's going to lead to wealth. And conversely, if you have the other mindset, the one that you shouldn't have, it's going to tend to lead towards poverty. And if you want to adjust your own financial thermostat, you know, you need to do these certain, have these certain beliefs that lead you to actions that are going to create wealth, and avoid these beliefs that lead to actions that will lead to poverty. So again, that's the disclaimer. I'm not saying here's the solution for societal poverty. And I'm not making statements about the moral character of poor people or denying the role of external factors in them being where they are now. But I am saying for you, the step forward is not to blame external factors. The step forward is to take responsibility for your own situation and to look for ways to improve it. So, you know, hopefully that would have gone without saying, but this is the internet and people are crazy on the internet. And so that's the disclaimer that underlies everything that we're going to talk about from here on out. So here we go. The 17 wealth files, the 17 mindset shifts that you need to adopt if you want to become rich. All right. Mindset shift number one: rich people believe I create my life. Poor people believe life happens to me. Now, do you really believe that you can control what direction your life goes? And hopefully you'll at least say that you do, but do your actions back it up? Because like, here's the deal. If you really believe that you can control the direction of your life, you will take action to get where you want to go. And if you don't, you won't. You know, you'll just kind of, well, I'm a victim of my circumstances. It's, you know, my parents' fault. It's my boss's fault. You know, it's my company's fault. And, you know, they laid me off. And, you know, you'll have a string of excuses as long as you're on it. Look, I get it. This is easier. It's easier to believe that life happens to you. It lets you off the hook. It's not your fault that you're poor or you're overweight or unable to find a good spouse. You know, it's just These are bad breaks that came your way. You're just playing the hand you were dealt. And listen, the reality, I'm not insensitive to this. Everyone is going to have their fair share of bad breaks. I get it. I've had bad breaks. You're going to have bad breaks. Sucks. It's reality. Cold, hard reality. You do get to choose how you respond. And so the first step in any journey forward in the land of personal development is going to be you admitting to yourself that you can make things better and that you have a responsibility to do so. Mindset shift number two, rich people play the money game to win. Poor people play the money game not to lose. So I used to hear all the time that human beings are risk averse. This is completely not true. We take risks all the time. We take carefully selected and managed risks, but we take risks all the time. And in fact, it's hard to get away from taking risks. Everything in life basically is a risk. Now, there's varying degrees of risk. What we really are is we're loss averse. And the sting of losing hurts more than the thrill of victory for most of us, most of the time. And when it comes to money, that's the way most of us play. So let me talk to you very specifically. If you've been procrastinating with putting your money in the stock market, you know, and of course, there's other things here you might be attributing this to. They just, you know, fear, uncertainty, you know, the unknown. But this is a symptom of playing the money game not to lose. You realize that if you put money in the stock market, you might lose it. Now, there's ways to do it that are, it's almost a guarantee that over time you won't lose money. There's certain strategies. But at any given moment, there's a chance that, you know, you might lose money. But here's the thing. I mean, there's no way to get ahead without a certain amount of risk. You know, there's three really good ways to turbocharge your wealth, to have your money start working for you. You know, you can start a business, you can invest in real estate, and you can invest in the stock market. There's some other ones. Those historically have been the three really big ones that tons of people have used very reliably to get ahead. And so those all involve somehow or another you taking on a certain amount of risk, but then your money is able to work for you. And, you know, in the case of starting a business, you chances are you actually have employees that, you know, you've hired that they start working for you. You know, in the case of the other ones, it's like you're putting your money into an asset that, you know, creates value for you. But, you know, no matter what, there's risk. And so, you know, I mean, here's the deal. In some cases, it doesn't even matter if you lose. Like, you can lose money on your first real estate deal, and it's not necessarily going to crush you, as long as you learn lessons that will help you multiply the value of your money through real estate investing. Like, you've just got to get started. And you've got to have this mindset that, like, listen, I'm playing this game to win. I can take the occasional short-term loss because, you know, at the end of the day, the thing that I'm really concerned about is I have these goals. I have these things that I want to move towards. And I have the confidence in myself that in adopting these mindsets that lead to wealth, even if I take a temporary step back, even if I take a short-term L, I can bounce back. I have the ability to make money. I have the ability to multiply my money. And so because of that, I'm getting aggressive and I'm playing to win. And so, you know, I think you can kind of choose the, like, I think everybody needs to think about at least one of those three vehicles. You can dabble in all three if you want, but starting a business, you know, investing in real estate, investing in the stock market. For sure, the easiest one and the most hands-off is the stock market. So figure that one out. And, like, if you're not in the game, like, man, get in the game. And then, you know, if you've been thinking about one of those other two because you think that you're you know, wired that way, man, jump in. Like, the timing is never going to be right. Just figure it out. Figure out the next step and get going. Play the money game to win. You know, stop playing just not to lose. Mindset shift number three, rich people are committed to being rich. Poor people want to be rich. Okay, here's the thing. Everyone wants to be rich, right? Given the choice between being poor and being rich, right? Between being broke is a joke and being just fabulously wealthy, very few of us would say, oh man, you know what? I would like to be struggling to get by. I would like to be concerned tomorrow about whether or not my kids are going to eat. That's what I would like. I would like to, just a life of constant anxiety about money, wondering whether the repo men are going to come and take away the car and going to lose the house, and just that's where I want to be. That's the good life right there. Everybody wants to become rich, but most people don't. So the desire alone is obviously not worth very much. So if you want to actually become rich, you need to be committed. And you need to be willing to take the next step forward, whether you feel ready or not. And you probably won't feel ready. You need to put in the work. You need to take risks, like we talked about in the last segment. And so, commitment, I mean, it depends on where you are right now. It might mean getting up earlier to work on your side hustle. It might mean getting a book that will improve your mind instead of catching up on Netflix. Whatever form it takes in your life right now, there should be tangible signs of your commitment that you can point to. Right, desire can be all talk, but commitment takes action. Mindset difference number four. Rich people think big, poor people think small. Okay, so I remember a while ago I was talking to my friend, and I just started dabbling in making money online, and I'd made some money, I think, off of YouTube and off of the Amazon affiliate program. I was maybe making like $300 a month. Online, and I was trying to get my friend to jump in and to start creating some content and to start monetizing his efforts, and he kept thinking like, this isn't going to go anywhere. I'm not going to be successful. I'm like, listen, with persistence, you can be. And eventually, I started to, I think, get him to come around and to see that maybe there was some potential here, and maybe he could make money online. And he said, yeah, you know what? I think I'm starting to see that if I really stuck with this, eventually I could maybe make enough that I could replace my $35,000 a year salary with the money that I'm making online. And I honestly think when he said this, that $35,000 for him was the most that he could imagine saying without me like sort of chastising him for being unrealistic. But I went the other way. I'm like, why are you thinking so small? $35,000 a year. Why are you setting the bar so low? Now, there's several reasons why I think that you need a big vision. First of all, it's just motivating, right? If you think that you're going to need to agonize for years just to get to the point of making $35,000 a year, you're going to spend a lot of time wondering if it's worth it. If, on the other hand, let's just say you're shooting for 10 times that amount, 20 times that amount, you no longer need to justify the work that you're putting into yourself. You're like, yeah, it's hard now, but like, man, the result, whew, wait till you see the result. But another reason I think you should think big is that, thinking big helps you think outside the box. So instead of thinking like, what would I need to do to get somebody to buy my $5 ebook, you start thinking, what would I need to do to get somebody to buy a $500 online course or a $5,000 online course? Or heck, what would I need to do to get somebody to pay me $50,000? I was thinking about this the other day, like, man, could I come up with an event that people would be willing to pay $50,000 to go to? You'd say like nobody's going to pay $50,000 to go to an event. Anytime you say the word nobody, you're wrong. You're almost, I mean, unless it's something like, nobody would disembowel themselves and, eat their own organs or something like that. Sorry, that was gross. But like, unless you're saying something like that, anytime that you're using that phrase, nobody, that word nobody in regular conversation, you are 100% wrong. Just indisputably, unless you're using it like as a hyperbole, which again, though, you don't need, you could have essentially nobody pay 50,000. Let's say five people is nobody. Five people paying you $50,000, that's $250,000. Let's say you wanted to make $100,000 that year and only work on this. You now have, right? So you have $250,000 of revenue coming in. You have $100,000 that you want to make as your income. You have $150,000 as a budget to come up with something really special that people are going to think it was worth paying for. Could you do that? Probably you could. You might not have even been thinking like this if you weren't thinking big, but you know, once you start thinking big, like, hey, what could I do to get somebody to pay me $50,000? You start getting creative. And you know, I think the last reason you need to start thinking big is it stretches you. I mean, this is pretty straightforward, pretty obvious, but instead of being complacent, instead of looking around at where you are now, you know, you can look onward and upward. So are you thinking big right now, or are you thinking small? You know, I think that it's good to dream big. It's good to have a compelling vision of a brighter future. You know, I think it's motivating. I think that it stretches you. I think that it helps you think outside the box. I encourage you, I start dreaming big. Mindset difference number five: rich people focus on opportunities. Poor people focus on obstacles. Okay, so here's a pet peeve of mine. Have you ever had somebody tell you, like, man, I thought of the idea for Uber before Uber? Then why didn't you do anything about it? Okay, so if I had to pick one explanation for why these people didn't do anything, I think I would settle on this one. Rich people focus on opportunities, poor people focus on obstacles. Because here's the deal, there's plenty of obstacles with any good idea you've ever heard. So let's take Uber. Uber is a stupid idea. Bad, 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 really no good idea. There's so many obstacles with it. Stop and think about it for a second. Why would anyone trust an unlicensed stranger to pick them up? And by the way, this is not just some, like, oh, okay, you're being weird and, like, you know, fringe. I know people who won't use Uber due to safety concerns. I know plenty of people like that. Other obstacles with Uber. How do you expect to compete with the well-established, trustworthy, you know, taxi business? Been around for decades, hundreds of years. Who knows how long the, I guess not hundreds plural, but maybe like 100 years. What do you do with the fact that you know, so many consumers, you know, and the people with the big money to spend are older and they struggle with, like, apps and new technology. Like, some of them adopt it, but in general, as a group, these are the people with the most money and the least likely to adopt your service. And I mean, again, we could just go on and on and on, and that's just the, you know, the objections, the obstacles that are inherent to the particular idea of Uber. But what about the obstacles to starting a business? Do you know how to start a business? Do you know how to incorporate and, you know, how to hire people and find accountants and take care of the money and, you know, even build the app in the first place and all these other things? You know, there is an endless, and I mean endless, string of obstacles that you can see whenever you have an idea. And that's why the ideas aren't worth anything. You know, you think, I need that next $1 million idea and I'll become a millionaire. When you get the next $1 million idea, you'll do nothing with it. Nothing. You will sit on your hands and wait till somebody else does it and then complain that you had the idea first. Right? If you want to start getting ahead, you need to change what you're seeing from seeing the obstacles to seeing the opportunities. Right? You'll have to encounter the obstacles, but you need to have the courage to tap to pursue, to chase after the opportunities that are in front of you. Mindset shift number six: rich people admire other rich and successful people. Poor people resent rich and successful people. And so, of course, this goes back to something we talked about earlier, the difference between an abundance mindset and a scarcity mindset. You know, the scarcity mindset thinks, like, oh no, the rich people took more than their fair share. They're evil. The abundance mindset says, wow, these people created a lot of value for society, and I should learn from them and imitate them, and, you know, society will be better off. You know, Zig Ziglar, the sort of the father of the grandfather, the great granddaddy of the personal development movement. One of the things he was famous for saying was, "You can have everything in life you want if you'll just help other people get what they want." And so that's a model that embraces this abundance mindset that, like, listen, you want to win, good. It's a good thing to want. Help other people win. And then a bunch of people win. We all win. And so, I mean, if you're a self-made millionaire, the way that people should rightly view that is like, wow, you have, I mean, I'm assuming like you didn't just, steal. I guess we wouldn't use this phrase self-made millionaire there, but I can see how you could, because it's like, well, I stole it, right? Assuming you came by your wealth, morally, ethically, legally, if you're a self-made millionaire, your actions have benefited a great many people, and everybody has won. And so, there's more to go around now. I'll admit, this is a point that I struggle with, admiring rich and successful people versus resenting them. I used to struggle more with it, and of course now I've very much come around that I'm spending much more time admiring other rich and successful people. Sometimes you can get the jealousy and the resentment though of, man, I want to be where they're at, and it's just so frustrating that it's not happening for me. And I think it's really important to, not judge where you are at the beginning of your journey to where somebody else is, in the middle of theirs. And there's people who I look at who I'm like, man, they've got the kind of, lifestyle I want, and they've escaped the corporate world of 9 to 5, and they're just making money from their website, their online business, whatever it is. And I think I can get there. I mean, I think I'm making good content that helps people, and that, eventually that's going to work around in my favor. But there's no shame in the game in not being where I want to be yet. In the meantime, I need to be admiring people and where they're at, be helping them, collaborating them. I think it's so important to both be helping people who are ahead of where you are and people who are behind where you are. The more that you give, the better it works out. So yeah, sometimes it's hard. We're all human. I get it. But man, if you want to get ahead, I think the best way in admire and emulate rich and successful people. Number 7, rich people associate with positive, successful people. Poor people associate with negative or unsuccessful people. Yikes. This is where stuff gets real. Who are you spending your time with? Are they making you better, or are they dragging you down? I mean, I've often heard the phrase that your network is your net worth. I've also heard that, hey, on you are the average of the 5 people you spend the most time around. And in fact, one of the best ways I've heard of predicting, guessing your income is you take the 5 people that you spend the most time around and you take the average of their income, and chances are that's pretty close to your income. So what about the people that you hang around? Do they invigorate you with their positive vibes? Or do they suffocate you with their negativity? I mean, look, let's just real honest here. The brutal truth, if you want to be successful, there's no room for negative vibes, for complaining. That friend that's always complaining, they either need to stop or they need to find somebody else to complain to. I mean, it's just, you got to escape the toxic environment. I don't see any way around this. You need to escape the toxic environment. There's people out there who are stuck in a mindset that's keeping them where they are, and they want to drag you down with them. And I hate to say that, and I know this gets personal and stuff, but like, you got to escape the toxicity, man. That's just it. Associate with other positive, successful people. Mindset shift number 8. Rich people are willing to promote themselves and their value. Poor people think negatively about selling and promotion. Okay, this is another one that I struggle with. And in fact, my boss and my performance reviews, one thing that consistently comes up is like, hey, you're not selling yourself enough. you're not taking enough credit for the things that you've done, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, I'll admit that this one is hard for me anyway. I think I see the value of it, or I think I see how it's an okay thing. You know, that I value humility. And, you know, I'm not a humble man. I wish I were a humble man. And so that value, I think, is a good value that can conflict. And that's where it gets tricky. I think in my head, I can make these two things work in harmony. But I will admit that sometimes it conflicts. And, you know, none of us ever want to be inconsistent. So I think it's possible to be both humble and to be willing to promote yourself. And I think the way that works is, you know, promoting yourself as a way of, you know, truly believing that you can help other people. And so you have other people's best interests in mind, as opposed to it being like a purely, you know, self-serving thing. Now, just from a pure practicality standpoint, I'll say that, and this one probably is one of the most obvious ones on here. You know, if you want to get ahead, if you want to be successful, you know, you've got to start being willing to promote yourself and your value. Everything is marketing. I mean, you know, marketing is not just advertising and selling products. Marketing is creating the change that you want to see happen. Marketing is what happens when you get somebody to take action. And so, you know, in order to be successful, you need people to take actions that, you know, you want them to take. And the way to do that is, you know, through promotion, through selling yourself, through marketing yourself. And so that's the way forward for all of us. And I'm definitely not saying that you need to become arrogant or cocky, but you need to have enough self-confidence that you believe that you have something good to offer. And that because you have something good to offer, the most humble thing to do, ironically, is to let people know about it, to let people know how you can help them, right? A fear of selling and promotion can do nothing but hold you back. All right, everyone, I'll be back with more points after a quick break for a word from our sponsors. Let me tell you about something that I love in general. I love easy-to-use free services that make my life better. Let me tell you about something that I love in particular that does all these things, the Cash App. Here's the deal. I never have cash on me anymore. Do you ever have cash on you? Nobody has cash on them anymore. This is fine, except for in those situations where, you know, you owe a few bucks for pizza and you don't have it, so you look like a deadbeat. Or even worse, when you're owed money for pizza and everybody's like, I don't have any cash on me, I'll get you back later. Yeah, that strategy never works. So here's the solution. Everybody always has their phone on them, and the Cash App is the easiest way to send and receive money. They have a beautiful user interface. It's intuitive. It's easy to use. And the best part about this is the deal that they have for you. If you go to thematthewkent.show/cash, that's thematthewkent.show/cash, you can download the Cash App for free. And the first time that you send $5 to somebody using the app, the Cash App will give you $5. That's right, $5 that'll hit your account, be transferred to your bank account just for using their service. What a great deal. And the best part is, I'll get $5 too. We all win. You get $5, I get $5. We spread the Cash App love to the next person. And this ball keeps rolling. So to take advantage of this offer, go to thematthewkent.show/cash. That's thematthewkent.show/cash. Mindset shift number 9, rich people are bigger than their problems. Poor people are smaller than their problems. All right, so have you ever heard somebody who's not successful trying to justify why they aren't successful? So they'll have a string of excuses as long as their arm. And every single one of the excuses shifts the blame to someone or something else. It's the government's fault. It's the old boss's fault. It's the, you know, I mean, the industry's in decline. The market's bad. It's not me, right? It's the market. You know, my coworkers don't do my job, don't do their jobs, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The way these people talk about their problems, you know, you think, oh man, like nobody can ever be successful. I mean, these problems, like nothing you can do about them. These things are bigger than you are. Successful people, on the other hand, realize, hey, yeah, there's problems, but you know what? These are obstacles that are going to need to be overcome if I'm going to continue succeeding. So it's your choice. Are your problems bigger than you and they're going to hold you down, or are you bigger than your problems? Again, there's the thing about these mindsets. You get to choose which mindset you adopt. Number 10, rich people are excellent receivers. Poor people are poor receivers. Bottom line, you need help. And, you know, hey, I'm in your corner. I fully believe you're capable of achieving your dreams, but you need help. If your pride doesn't let you receive help, your pride's holding you back and needs to be put in check. So, one of the benefits of receiving, in addition to the fact that you receive something that you want or need or could use, but it's the strengthening of a relationship. So, if someone is offering to give you something, help or something of value or whatever they're offering to give you, you know, you might be thinking along the lines of, "Oh no, I couldn't accept that. It would put me in their debt, or like it makes me look weak." Or and again, that's pride, and you got to get rid of the pride. But no, what it really is an opportunity to build a relationship. If they give you something and you receive it, that act of goodwill between you is bringing you closer together, building a relationship, and relationships are critical. So if you deny the help that others offer, you pass up on a free opportunity to build relationships. Now, another thing that I think you need to start, like not just stuff, not just help, I think you need to start receiving compliments. And so earlier I said, hey, put your pride in check. And you might be thinking like, okay, well, if I need to put my pride in check, then I need to, you know, practice humility. And that means that if somebody says, you know, hey, you did a great job, and you, oh no, I'm terrible, I'm worthless, I'm a worm. That's not real humility. That's false humility. Now, I want you to really think about that. It looks like humility because you're putting yourself down, but putting yourself down doesn't equal humility. You know, you're just posturing there, which is, if anything, is more pride, is more self-centeredness, is more selfishness. You're thinking about yourself, you're thinking about how you come off. Here's what I want you to think. I don't know if you've ever considered this. What are you saying about the other person if they're saying, hey, you're really good at this, and you're saying, no, I'm terrible, it's awful. You're contradicting them. You're saying you are saying to the person who's giving you a compliment, you're wrong. It's kind of a rude thing to say. Here's the deal. True humility honors the person who is being kind to you, honors their kindness, honors them, dignifies them as a person. When it comes to receiving compliments, the humble thing to do, this is counterintuitive, but if you actually understand what humility is, I promise you this is true. The humble way to react to a compliment is to graciously accept it. It might be awkward, it might make you uncomfortable. It's the humble thing to do. It takes real humility to accept a compliment, you know, to look at somebody and say, thank you. I'm honored that you would give me that compliment. It takes real humility to do that, and real humility is hard, but like, here's the thing, it's worth it. So you should be willing to receive. Rich people are excellent receivers. Poor people are poor receivers. You should receive gifts. You should receive help. You should receive advice. You should receive compliments. You should be somebody who receives. Number 11, rich people choose to get paid based on results. Poor people choose to get paid based on time. I love, love, love this one. I mentioned earlier, there's the triple constraint of life. There's time, there's energy, or we could call that one attention, or whatever we want to call that one, focus. There's time, there's energy, and there's money. Those are the three constraints. And of course, to some extent, you can use some of these resources to get some of the others, but they're not all equally valuable. At the end of the day, at the end of your life, you're going to be wishing that you had more time. You're not going to be wishing that you had more money in the bank. Time is incredibly important. Now, we all start out with a lot of time and not a lot of money. So we say, okay, well, it makes sense to use time to get money. Yes, it does, but be careful. Because time is inherently more valuable than money, you need to be wary about trading your time for money unless you're getting like an obscene hourly rate, which some people do. I mean, if you're, you know, getting paid as a public speaker, you might be getting an obscene hourly rate, you know, if you're a consultant, that kind of thing. And I'm not saying it's wrong, you know, to have a job or a wage or a salary, but there's other ways of thinking about this. And so one of them is getting paid based on results. And so one way to do that is to move to like a sales position and, you know, however much you sell, that's however much money you make is the commission, the percentage off of that. I think it's worth thinking about how can you're going to have to use time almost assuredly to get money. How can you invest, right? Not trade time, not spend time. How can you invest? Invest is something that, you know, it's going to have an ongoing future benefit. How can you invest your time in creating an asset, creating something that you can sell besides time? So you could build a product, you could build, you know, a business, you can, you know, invest your money in the stock market like we talked about earlier. What can you do that is going to have an ongoing future benefit? And so this was a big premise of my book, Personal Finance That Works For You. Again, that key phrase there at the end of it, works for you, having your money working for you. I'll link to that in the show notes. This is a big premise of one of the most popular articles that I ever wrote, which is called Have You Ever Mastered the Basics of Making Money? In which I argue that the one way to make money is by selling things. And so you need to think about, you know, most people are selling their time. How do you create something that you can sell besides time? Again, I'll link to that article. I'll link to my book in the show notes. But this is an incredibly important thing to think about. You know, getting paid based on results is scary because you might not put up the results. You know, the time is kind of easy because, you know, at work, they, you know, as long as I show up, you know, maybe eventually if your performance is bad enough, you get fired. But really, when you think about it at work, I mean, they're paying you just to show up. You know, they care about whether or not your butt is in that seat from, you know, 8 to 5. At a lot of jobs, I would argue most jobs, they don't even know how well you're performing at your job. They don't really even have a way of measuring how much value you provide to the organization. They're just paying you for your time. And I mean, yeah, that's okay. But again, your time is valuable. You need to come up with ways that you only have so many hours that you can trade in for time, right? If you really want to get rich, multiply your wealth, you got to start brainstorming some of these ways that you can break this relationship between time and money, that you can skew it in your favor. Rich people get paid based on results. Poor people get paid based on time. Number 12, rich people think both, poor people think either or. And so this goes back a little bit to the abundance versus the scarcity mindset. Do you honestly believe that we can both win? Or do I have to lose so that you can win? Can we both get what we want? Or is it going to be one or the other of us? Can we collaborate and build each other up? Or are we destined to fight and tear each other down? So, you know, beyond just areas of like competition versus cooperation, this also applies to, you know, how you manage your time and your resources. You know, there's sometimes things are a trade-off. There's a lot of trade-offs in life, but sometimes you really can't have both. So, you know, should you focus on the present or on the future? Both. If you're creating content, should you focus on quantity or quality? Both. There's a way of doing both. You know, and I argued this in a post a while back. I'll link to it in the show notes. The most likely path to quality is quantity. You know, the more output you have, the better you'll get over time. So a lot of things seem like an either or, like just a strict trade-off. But even though it might be hard in a lot of cases to find a way to do both, there are people who are doing it. So sometimes you will have to choose either or, but your first instinct should always be to ask, can I choose both here? And in fact, even like, you know, somebody gives you an option, like, you know, you're somewhere and they're like, hey, do you want the chocolate chip cookie or do you want the sprinkle cookie? Can I have both? Right? Maybe you can't. Like, maybe they're like, no, you can't have both. And like, okay, fine, you know, chocolate chip. But maybe they say yes. Like, I mean, you know, always look for the way to have both before you actually make the trade-off. You look for opportunity. Well, that's one of the core premises about this whole mindset thing in the first place is like, listen, if you're looking for opportunities, you'll find some. You won't find them every single time you look, but you will find them, right? Just a simple principle. Look for opportunities and you'll find them. Number 13, rich people focus on their net worth. Poor people focus on their working income. Now, don't get me wrong, I want a high working income, but here's the deal. This would be a strongly worded statement. You might disagree. Your working income doesn't matter when it comes to getting rich because it's just one piece of the puzzle, right? If you have an incredibly high working income, you make $300,000 a year. But you spend $400,000 a year, you are not going to get rich. You are going to get in debt up to your eyeballs. You're going to get in debt past your eyeballs, right? So when you take a step back and you start looking at your net worth, you know, a few things happen. First of all, you realize, like, listen, I need to be spending my money on things that build up my net worth, putting my money into vehicles that build up the net worth. And you'll also, when that happens, you start building assets, you'll start putting your money towards areas where your money can make money for you, right? You know, investing in real estate is something like this, you know, stock market, the things like we've talked about. You know, in my book, I've said, like, look, personal finance can be summed up in less than 10 words. Spend less than you earn and invest the difference. And so, yes, a major part of that is earn more. And I talk about that in the book, and I talk about that in general. I think everybody should be focused on how to earn more. But of course, it's just one piece of the puzzle. You need the other three. You need to be getting your expenses under control, and you need to have a way to invest, to have your money multiply. Spend less than you earn and invest the difference is a way of focusing on how much wealth you are accumulating. You're building wealth up over time instead of just dissipating all your money and throwing it all away. Number 14, rich people manage their money well. Poor people mismanage their money well. All right, so I remember reading a while back in USA Today that, according to a recent study, the people with the lowest net worth have the highest credit card debt as a group. Ouch. Ouch. You know, hey, debt is too big of a topic to get into fully here. I'll just say that the golden rule of borrowing. The golden rule of debt is, I would say, it could be summed up in less than 5 words: only borrow to build. In other words, the cost of borrowing, i.e., the interest that you pay, should be outweighed by the benefits, the financial benefits that you get in return. And so this happening, I mean, you know, there's different places people like debt is always risky, but you know, like student loans can work this way, a mortgage can work this way, a loan to start a business can work this way. So debt can be used wisely, but I mean, consumer debt, yikes. You know, you're buying stuff that doesn't go up in value, and chances are is like nearly worthless soon after you buy it, and you just want to replace it. You know, you're like, oh, I need that new TV. You don't need that new TV. You're like, I need that new TV, and then you buy the new TV, and then, you know, next year it's not the newest TV anymore. And you're like, I need a new TV again. You don't need a new TV again, by the way. But you know, if you pay for that with debt, it's like you're going to work to earn money, not to pay for the stuff that you can buy now, but to pay for the stuff that you already bought. And the stuff that you already bought, you're sick of. Like, not a great decision. And listen, okay, you know, that can be insensitive to those of you who are in debt up to your eyeballs. But like, I'm not trying to be like, I think in all honesty, if you're in debt up to your eyeballs with consumer debt like that, like you're doing that kind of thing, you buy the new TV. Because you think you need a new TV, you don't need a new TV. Because you think you need a new TV, you need some tough love and you need some better perspective to be, somebody to come alongside you and say, like, hey, this is a silly game that you're playing and you should probably stop it, like, right now. I think there's other areas too where this difference between, poor people and rich people and how they manage their money manifests itself. One of the things that I've observed anecdotally is that rich people, I think, are orders of magnitude more likely to invest in themselves, to buy the books and the courses and the things that they need to be successful, to invest in their own business, that kind of thing. A really great illustration of this came from the all-time classic personal finance book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, by a guy named Robert Kiyosaki. And so he recounts a story, a powerful story. I think it's in the appendix of the book, or maybe the updated edition or something like that. And he recounts this story of his neighbor and him at one point were both investing in real estate at the same time. And he said his neighbor went out and bought a condo as an investment property for $100,000. Robert bought the identical unit next door for $50,000. And he said he learned how to do that. He bought it at an auction, like a foreclosure auction. He learned how to buy properties for cheap at a foreclosure auction from like a weekend seminar that he paid $500 to go to. And he said, "Hey, my neighbor looked at the $500 price tag and was like, that's too much. I'm not paying $500 for that." So it cost him $50,000 because he bought the condo for $100,000 instead of buying the one for $50,000. And Robert's like, man, he's in a place where he's like stuck now because he paid too much. I told him that you make money when you buy, not when you sell. And so he's just waiting for the price to go up. He's like, I don't need the price to go up because the condo's worth twice as much as I paid for it. But my friend who didn't invest in himself waits for the price to go up. And so that's the power. I mean, $500 is a pretty big price tag for a weekend. $250 a day for a seminar? Like, come on. But like, this is the way that rich people operate. They recognize the step that's needed to get ahead, and they say this is going to be way worth it in the long run, and they manage their money well by allocating it towards those things that are going to benefit them most in the long run, not the things that they're going to be regretting and kicking themselves for later, like buying the new TV. You don't need a new TV. Number 15, rich people have their money work hard for them. Poor people work hard for their money. So, like I've already touched on, rich people put their money into money-making vehicles, stocks, real estate, their own business, etc., etc. Their money is earning money, right? Not just their time, their money is earning money. Like we just talked about in the last segment, poor people get into debt and have to work longer hours to pay for money they already spent. Again, so key here. Are you doing things that make the most sense in the long run? Or are you only focused on the short run? We all know that you can make a lot of money if you invest early. But unless, a lot of it, you fall into this trap of like, oh, I don't have that much to invest now. Invest it because now's the best time. Invest the little that you have, and I mean, this is how anything works. You almost never see results in the beginning. So if you do invest now, you might not see any results year one. Any. You might lose money. But this last year, the stock market as a whole lost money, 2018. Might lose money. The results come in the long run. The results snowball, they compound. If you have faith in the system and an orientation towards looking towards the future, if you're able to trust the process, you're going to get ahead, right? Rich people have their money work hard for them because they can see the long-term view. Number 16, rich people act in spite of fear. Poor people let fear stop them. All right, listen. If the things you wanted in life could be found in your comfort zone, you'd already have them. If the things you wanted in life could be found in your comfort zone, you'd already have them. Things like building wealth, becoming successful, require you to take the scary act of stepping out of your comfort zone and executing on the things that will make you successful. And listen, I get it. Fear is scary. Kind of a ridiculous quote. Fear is scary. I mean, obviously. There's the fear of failure. There's the fear of the unknown. There's the fear of success. I have a friend, Adam, who recently said, he pointed this out. I introduced him to the fear of success. Like, hey, if I, start a business, I'm going to have to learn how to incorporate the bit and all that kind of stuff. That's the fear of success. Like, if things start working, I'm going to have to figure out the tax situation and accounting, all that. He's like, that's really just the fear of failure, but it's the fear of future failure. It's like the fear of success bringing on things that you won't be good at, or that you won't be able to learn, or that you'll mess up. And by the way, I'll just say this. In anything that you do, you will mess up. It's not something to be afraid of. It's something to face and to just say and to own and say, okay, I'm going to do this. I'll make some mistakes, but this is the road that's going to lead to the results that I want. One of my big recommendations here when it comes to acting in spite of fear, it's not a silver bullet, but I think it's pretty good, is to make your dreams bigger than your fears. As we talked in an earlier section about dreaming big, my favorite way to do this is with an exercise that I call the 10-year plan for a remarkable life. It's not something I came up with. It was passed on by a woman named Debbie Millman, amazing graphic designer and author named Debbie Millman. And I did an episode about it already. So if you go to thematthewkent.show/3, that was my episode on the 10-year plan for a remarkable life. I think when it comes to facing your fears, it helps to push through your fears if on the other end of fear, you see a compelling vision of a brighter future. So, however you do it, though, you've got to start learning to act in spite of fear. And finally, we've made it to the end. Thanks for sticking with me so far. Number 17, rich people constantly learn and grow. Poor people think they already know. Whew. All right. Here's another statement for you to ponder. The version of you that exists in your dreams, your compelling vision for a better future, doesn't just have stuff that you want. They know things that you don't. So if you want the stuff, you need to first seek out the knowledge that's going to get you there. There's a quote that I love. Is reported that at one point a reporter asked Malcolm X, like, what's your alma mater? And he had the most brilliant reply that I've ever heard. He said, books. Now, I mean, you can learn however you want. If you want to learn through, more formal education and school and classes, or if you want to go find online courses and, video lectures or free videos on YouTube or whatever, I'll just say the reason I like books is, an author could spend a year writing a book. They could spend 2 years. In some crazy cases, they could even spend 10 years writing a book. And in a lot of cases, even if they spent like a year writing a book, the only reason they were able to do so, there's a lot of people, like let's say maybe like a psychologist or an academic or somebody, the only reason they were able to write a book, invited to write a book by the publisher, is because of decades of work and of research, over time. So it's not, it takes maybe 8 hours, I don't know, 10 hours to read a fairly normal book. It's not an exaggeration to say that you can get the biggest benefits of decades of research with 8 to 10 hours of investment of your time when you read a book. Not all books are that good, but that's certainly possible. And so I think right now book, and I love blogs and I love podcasts. This is, I'm recording a podcast for you now. I think, I hope that you learn a lot from it. I hope that it makes you think. But I think for my money, I think books are still probably one of the highest quality sources of information out there that you can use. I've heard Dale Partridge. There's a podcast called the Startup Camp Podcast, and he said something once to the effect of, "If you're not reading at least 6 books a year, you're not investing enough in your continuing education." And I believe that. I mean, I challenge you, if you're not reading at least 6 books a year, make that your goal. And like my goal is way beyond that. My goal is not 6 books this year. My goal is 60. I'm a little bit behind. I'm not that far behind. So it's April right now, and I've read Oh geez, how many have I read? I checked it. It was like 15 or 16 books that I've read this year, and I'm almost done with another one, so I add another one to that soon. So I'm like close to being on pace. The last couple of years, I read, I think it was like 59 books 1 year, and I don't remember how many the other, but like 50 plus books each year the last 2 years. You don't have to jump right in there. You don't have to read 50 books a year, a book a week, that kind of thing. But I'd challenge you, if you're reading less than 6 books a year, I'd say a very high priority of yours should be, read more than 6 books this year. And again, you don't have to. You can go somewhere else, but you need to be thinking about your own continuing education. And if you don't have a solid plan already in place, I just recommend books. Highest quality sources of information around. Just my opinion, man. All right, so those are the 17 wealth files. Now, I'll just say here, as by way of a closing remark, usually I think when somebody starts talking about mindset, we're like, oh, this is just self-help nonsense. The reason we tend to do that is because, like, oh, changing your mindset is easy, and we know that success isn't easy. But I think that's an incorrect premise. I don't think changing your mind is easy. There's nothing easy about getting rid of the beliefs that you've held on to for years and adopting a new set. It involves humility, it involves admitting that you were wrong about the way you were thinking about something. And I've admitted to you, even in the course of this podcast, I know all the right answers now. I know the right side of these different dichotomies that I should be on, but on a couple of these, I'm still leaning towards the wrong side. It's hard. It's hard to change your mindset. So, I think that this is the hard work that needs to happen first. I think there's the battle in your mind that needs to happen. And then I think that it needs to manifest itself in actions that are going to lead you towards your goals and towards the things that you want and towards success and towards wealth and towards, all of these kind of things. So, those are my thoughts. And again, the book that these the actual points came from was called Secrets of the Millionaire Mind by T. Harv Eker. So I'm gonna put that in the show notes, and you can find those at thematthewkent.show/6. The number 6, so this is episode 6, thematthewkent.show/6 will be the show notes. But I really hope that you found something in here that challenged you and have some way of moving forward. All right, so last segment, what I'm reading. I feel like this has been a long episode today, and I thought about cutting this segment. But the last point that I made about the mindset stuff was rich people constantly learn and grow, poor people think they already know. And I made the argument that, like, hey, you should be reading books. So it'd be kind of weird in the same episode that I made that point about reading books to cut the segment where I talk about the books that I'm reading. So here we go. It's actually a book that I just finished, and it's called Digital Minimalism by Cal Newport. And so Cal's a great author. He wrote a great book called So Good They Can't Ignore You, and a really great book called Deep Work. And then this is his newest book, a very timely book called Digital Minimalism. Now, look, right at the outset, I am not against technology. I'm not against smartphones. I'm not against social media. In fact, this podcast, I don't know if you know much about how this is happening. I am not in a recording studio. I do not have a fancy microphone. I do not have fancy paid software. I do not have a producer. I don't have anything. This podcast, it's a service called Anchor. You've probably heard the advertisements because they sponsor the show. It's an app. It's a smartphone app. I am talking into my spot. I'm in the guest room in my house. I have my smartphone in my hand, and I am talking into my smartphone, and that is this podcast. Welcome behind the scenes. Glad you got to see how the donuts are made. All right, anyways. Sausage is made, donuts are made. I don't know what that phrase. Glad you got to see how the sausage is made. Anyways, digital minimalism. So I'm not against technology. Cal's not, although he's never been on social media. But he and I and other people like Sherry Turkle, who wrote Reclaiming Conversation, and many, many others. I read another book about this called like How to Break Up with Your Phone or something like that. But we recognize that there are pitfalls, that there are apps on your phone that are designed to suck up as much of your time and attention as possible. And as we've talked about, the resource, you have three main resources at your disposal, the triple constraint of life. You have your time, your attention, and your money. And we spent a lot of this episode talking about your money. And so, it kind of actually works out that now we're talking about the other two, your time and your attention, which are precious and rare and valuable. And these are the things that these companies, Facebook and Google and whoever, are trying to suck up because that's how they make their money. They make their money off of your time and attention because they can sell it to advertisers. And so there's a lot on there that's, designed like a slot machine. Like Facebook is literally the news feed and everything is designed like a slot machine, and like intermittent rewards that like, light up your brain like a Christmas tree. And it's also designed to make you discontent. And the idea is they sell and designed to steal all your information, and they sell that to advertisers who can come and target the things that the things that you want, the areas where you know that you're inadequate or you think that you're inadequate. And it's a dangerous place. We all need to realize the dangers, right? So I'm not saying like get rid of your smartphone, get rid of no, like I'm not I don't think that things would be better if we went back to the technology that we had in like 1500. Not even a little bit. But every person, I think every person owes it to themselves to very carefully examine their relationship with technology and really to ask themselves the question, are you driving? Like, who's in control here? Are you in control? Or is an algorithm in control of your time and attention? It's a humbling question. Are you in control of your time and attention, or is an algorithm in control of your time and attention? I think a lot of us are not going to like the answer. And so I highly recommend this book and others like it, such as Reclaiming Conversation by Sherry Turkle, that point out that, like, listen, you can be pro-technology and cautious about the drawbacks. Almost anything in life, there's advantages and disadvantages, there's pros and cons. So it's important to know with modern technology, with Web 2.0, with social media, with smartphone apps, where are the dangers and how are you going to mitigate them? Because to a large extent, the quality of your life is going to depend on it. So another book, I think I mentioned this one already on the podcast, by Gene M. Twenge. It's a generational study called iGen. And so it ends up, it's about young people, but it ends up being about modern technology because that's the thing that most defines the generation that's growing up, and that's, teenagers and college students right now, is their relationship to technology. And she makes the point that, like, listen, we may be on the verge of one of the biggest mental health crises that we've ever seen, and a lot of it can be traced back to Instagram and Facebook. Not even an exaggeration there. Instagram and Facebook and that kind of stuff. So it's worth thinking about. Check out the book. Check it out from the library. Buy the book. Whatever you want to do there. Digital Minimalism by Cal Newport. Really think about your relationship to technology. All right, that's all I got for you today. If you enjoyed what you heard here, I really appreciate it. If you share this episode with somebody who you think could use it, if you want to find the show notes, you can go to thematthewkent.show/6. And I really hope I'll see you next time.